Have council signed in? Thank you. Thank you. We're ready when you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Kathleen Ortiz, representing Alicia Granado. As the court is probably aware, this is...
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I don't think I'll need the rebuttal time.
All right.
I am going to be brief on this.
All right.
As you're probably aware, this has taken a rather convoluted path to getting before Your Honors, having gone from this court, the Supreme Court, remanded back. The conviction arose from events occurring on December 12, 2012, when Mr. Granado was approached by officers with guns drawn as he sat in a car when they were responding to a report of an potentially intoxicated person, potentially armed, disorderly, and had essentially located his car, not having seen him driving it. The issue that was raised...
Didn't one officer see it? They passed one another.
He did, but I think at that time the description of the car had not actually been put out to him. Otherwise, I suspect he would have turned on the car at that point. I think what's indicated in the statement of facts is that the officer, after having received the dispatched information about the description, he and another officer subsequently surveilled the area, found a car legally parked.
The engine was running, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the headlights were on.
Headlights were on.
Yes, ma'am. And at that point, they repeatedly ordered Mr. Granado, who was found to be the occupant, to exit the car. Now, I would note that this is in December of 2012, although it's not stated in the record as to the temperature. December 12, 2012, I think is a reasonable inference that it was probably pretty cold out. Windows were probably up. But
upon just to be clear, they were looking for an intoxicated individual who may have been armed.
Yes, ma'am. So at that point, after having yelled repeatedly, they forcibly removed Mr. Granado from the car after having pulled their weapons, approaching from both sides of the car, both officers armed with their weapons drawn. Both officers were present as he's forcibly removed from the car, forcibly put on the ground, handcuffed behind his back, and then his body is maneuvered by the officers to get onto his feet and move to the rear driver's side of the car. And at that point, the question is put to him as to what he was doing out there. Subsequent statements were made by Mr. Granado indicating whether he was or was not operating the vehicle. At trial, the...
And some statements that could be characterized as of an abusive nature towards the law enforcement officers.
Yes, Your Honor. But I don't think he was being charged with curse and abuse.
No, but just going to the greater point of how he was then handled thereafter.
Your Honor, yes. But what we're talking about is what happened up to that point. I think that's what the court has to concentrate on, is the actions of the officers at the time they actually located the car, the actions of the officers in pulling the weapons, forcibly removing him from the car, forcing him to the ground, handcuffing him behind the back.
And isn't there a reasonable inference that he did know that the police were approaching and were yelling commands at him, given that they witnessed him throw something from the front seat into the back seat as they were approaching the vehicle?
I don't know that there is. Again, given the time of the year in December, there wasn't testimony or evidence in the statement of facts as to whether windows were up or not, but I think a reasonable inference is that the windows were up.
What so other inference can you draw from the fact that he took the keys out of the ignition and threw them in the back seat?
That he was getting ready to get out of the car.
Well, how about the statement, I pulled over to sleep it off?
I think there are a number of different scenarios that could have accounted for the fact that he had taken... Arguably, that he had, from what they testified to, that they said they saw him remove the keys, other than the fact that he was trying to subvert the officer's actions. But the fact of the matter remains is that the officers engaged in conduct that was the equivalent, or to him, under a reasonable person standard, was the equivalent of taking him into custody. As stated in the...
And just to be clear, the statement that you have, that is at issue is... the statement that he was just going to sleep it off. I just parked my car and was going to sleep it off.
Right. And I don't think there's any elaboration on what he meant by that. Was he going to sleep off that he'd been working all day? Did he sleep off that he had been drinking? Again, that leaves it open to speculation as to what he meant by that.
Or at least an inference based on the other attendant circumstances.
Correct. But I think one thing of his importance is that the officers did not make any attempt to actually verify information that had been received through dispatch. They did not report to the location where the original call had come from. They simply received this call through dispatch.
Well, but in fairness, they were looking, the updated information was they were looking for a particular car that the one officer had seen, believed he had seen.
Well, yes. At the time the initial officer saw it, I think all he noted was he had seen a light-colored Cadillac Seville.
Right, so he was going to verify to see if that was the drunk individual with the gun.
Well, the purportedly drunk individual.
Right, that's what the caller had.
Yes, ma'am.
Had said.
But I think when you look at all the circumstances together, this is not just one thing isolated. It was not just an officer approaching on foot and making demands. It was not just an officer pulling weapon. It was not just an officer removing him forcibly from the car, and not just the officer forcibly placing him on the ground. It was all these events in tandem, in sequence, and although it's not clear as to how quickly they all occurred together, all those events together that led to what we believe were the equivalent of an individual being in custody and subsequent questioning by the officers without benefit of Miranda. As the Commonwealth points out in their brief in opposition, in a footnote, references the Dixon case, which is a 2005 Supreme Court case. In that case, the Supreme Court held, in circumstances that were much less extreme than what we have here, that the individual, under an objective reasonable person standard, was in custody. I think the ruling in that case is actually more on point to the circumstances we have here, and we actually have more, factors to consider. We have two officers. We have two officers both with guns drawn. We actually have physical conduct, forcible physical conduct, not just a polite, please step out of your car, and Mr. Granato complying with that. What's stated in the statement of facts is that he was forcibly removed from the car. Now, those are the facts as were summarized in the statement of fact. What the actual testimony was, I'm not sure. I wasn't present at that time.
Doesn't matter. We got the statement
correct.
Of facts. So.
But I think even where, those are the statements where we have factors that are in addition to those which the Supreme Court and Dixon had previously found were enough under the reasonable person standard to equate to a custodial situation, that the factors here certainly surmount that, and thus it's our position that he was in custody and any subsequent statements obtained through questioning would be and should have been ruled inadmissible.
Ms. Ortiz, doesn't this really boil down to application of Dixon and Hassan?
Yes.
And whether this case, where this case falls in the continuum based on the actions of the officers and...
Yes, ma'am. And I think I had read Hassan. I know I did not include it in my brief, but I think this case falls somewhere between Dixon and Hassan. I think Hassan was more intrusive, but it's greater than what was found by the Supreme Court in Dixon to have equated to a reasonable, under reasonable person standard in a custodial situation.
Well, in Dixon, they put him in the car.
But they didn't have two officers with guns drawn, forcible physical conduct applied against the defendant. So I think when you look at those factors, I guess the question is, does one factor deserve more weight than another? I don't think the courts have ever determined that, but when you've got all of them together, the combined weight of what was done in Mr. Granato's case, I think, puts it at a higher level, although not necessarily as high a level as Hassan, a higher level than Dixon.
And it's clearly a totality of the circumstances situation. And with an agreed statement of facts, it's pretty straightforward. The facts are certainly not in dispute at this juncture. And so it's just merely figuring out what the facts in this case suggest in terms of the existing case law.
I agree.
Was it the functional equivalent of custody?
I agree. I'll reserve the remainder of my time, and I'll rely on my brief for the second assignment of error.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Murphy?
Good morning, Your Honors. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. The court has already sort of narrowed the issue here. The question is, did the police do too much under the doctrine that they are entitled to maintain the status quo That is, when you are entitled to effect a Terry stop, and there's no dispute on that, the defendant concedes that the stop was fine. The officers have certain powers at that point. They're able to maintain the situation. If the suspect begins to run away, they can physically seize him in order to question him. If he becomes violent, they can take steps to protect themselves in a way that allows them to do their duty of confirming or dispelling suspicion about this particular suspect. Now, the facts in this case that you had a report of a disorderly individual who had been asked to leave the event at which he was present because of his condition, who was intoxicated and possibly armed. Now, this came from a informant who was identified. Page 14, I think it is, of the appendix, states that the dispatcher provided the name and address of the informant. So we had clear suspicion not only of the possibility of the firearm, but of an intoxicated driver. And when they get, when they finally discover him, they approach him. And the idea that he didn't know what was going on is, I think, pretty silly here, because they yelled, as they phrased it, several times, "Show your hands." And he didn't comply as they got closer and closer to the vehicle. He did remove his keys from the ignition.
That was after the yelling had begun.
Yes, and threw them into the back seat. I don't know why he did that, but it certainly indicates he knows something's going on at this point. So instead of complying with the police, he does nothing. You know, they are concerned he may have a weapon in his hand. He then leans forward in the car, and they rush in, pull him out, put him down, handcuff him, and then put him beside the car.
And I think, when did they secure their weapons? Is it clear in the record when they secure their weapons?
No, I think they did take the weapons out as they approached him, but it doesn't say when they put them away, I don't believe. But what we do know is that at that point, when they took that vigorous physical action, they were faced with a potentially armed, intoxicated individual who would not cooperate with them. It's 2 o'clock in the morning on a rural road, so clearly there's some kind of concern, extreme concern for their own safety at this point.
And at the time he made the throwing motion under the back seat, I believe the statement of facts reflects that the officers didn't know whether that was a weapon or keys or anything else.
Right, they in fact asked him
danger.
What he had thrown. And of course, after they had secured him, they then looked in the vehicle and didn't see any gun and didn't find a gun on his person. But in fact, at this point, they had already secured him. They didn't lock him in the cruiser. And Dixon, they, in fact, locked him in the cruiser. Didn't just put him in the cruiser, locked him in there by himself. He was handcuffed. And here we have a situation where they undertake physical steps to protect themselves from a non-cooperating suspect. And as soon as they secured him, they put him up. They don't assert any pressure. They said, simply, "What are you doing out here? What are you doing here?" And at that point, he responds with this, "Doesn't make any difference. I was just driving over here to sleep it off." Importantly, none of those statements are really important to the Commonwealth's conviction of this individual, because he was sitting in a vehicle with the keys in the ignition, the motor running.
That goes to your harmless error point, though.
That's right. It's
right.
Clearly harmless error.
It doesn't go to your whether he was in custody.
Right. I mean, the question there is, even if this were error, what he says is, you can't prove I was driving. Well, of course, they don't have to. All they had to prove was that he was sitting in the car, even if the motor had been off, with the keys in the ignition, on the Enriquez now, that is operating a motor vehicle. So this man was operating a motor vehicle, drunk. Well, he was clearly drunk. Before they even questioned him, they said...
they noticed a number of things before they questioned him.
Yeah,
they noticed
His eyes,
glassy eyes, et cetera.
He was disheveled, his face was flushed. So they knew this man was drunk, and they could approve it without any reference to his statement. And the statements really didn't add anything. What we have, in fact, is a situation where he is driving. They already noticed that he's operating the vehicle. They clearly had probable cause even before he said anything to arrest this man. As soon as they stepped out of the car and they noticed his condition, they had probable cause to arrest this man for DUI.
Distinguish this case from Dixon.
Well,
why does Dixon not apply?
Well, Dixon is different because not only did they handcuff him, but they secured him, locked him in the back of the cruiser. Here we have all they've done is they want to talk to this man. They don't want to arrest him. They don't want to take him anyplace. They just want to talk to him. But in order to do that, they have to get him secured. Now, if he had raised his hands and said, look, nothing here, then there wouldn't have been any problem. You know, they wouldn't have been entitled at that point to take him out, take him to the ground. But this man refuses to cooperate. He will not show his hands, throw something into the back seat, and they, at that point, jump in there, drag him out, and then leans forward, and they, I think, reasonably took him to the ground, handcuffed him, put him up, and said, well, let's talk about what's going on here. At that point, all they had done was secure him for purposes of the Terry stop. There's no indication at that point they intended to arrest him. They wanted him to do the sobriety tests, you know, to determine, are you in fact, you know, drunk? You appear to be drunk, but let's check it out. And he says, no, I won't do that. But I don't think at that point they had determined to arrest him. They had determined merely to find out what's going on here.
Well, and they wanted to find the gun.
Well,
right?
They did want to find the
gun. Assuming there was a gun
somewhere. They wanted to find a gun. They wanted to be able to search the vehicle without any concerns about him. So they secured him by putting handcuffs on and then looked into the vehicle. And at that point, they asked him, what's going on? He responded with, you know, this basically stupid response that doesn't make any difference. I'm fine. You can't arrest me because you didn't see me driving. But I think here the situation is fully, their action was fully supported by the need to protect themselves. This man gave them lots of suspicion about what he was doing and how dangerous he was. And rather than dispelling that, he sort of increased that concern by failing to comply. At that point, they took him out, secured him sufficiently that they could talk without any danger to themselves. And at that point, he made statements, which they didn't even, as I said, they didn't even need. That the error would be harmless in any event because of that. And I will also rest on a brief with respect to the second point.
Thank you. Ms. Ortiz?
If I can, just a few things that concern me, or maybe some assumptions have been made. Was he armed with a gun? I don't know where that word has been introduced in the record. I think the only information that the officers had is that he was possibly armed. Well, was that, you know, it's a pocket knife or was it a gun? And I think that's the problem, is that sometimes we jump to assumptions that something more is happening. And I think it's exactly
Well, it's no less dangerous to the law enforcement officer if he's armed with a knife than if he's armed with a gun.
Well, I think that may not necessarily be true, because a gun, I think, obviously has further reach than a knife does.
Right, but under the officer safety line of cases, they just talk about officer safety looking at any kind of being armed with anything.
Well, and, Your Honor, I guess the problem I have here is that the officers had not done anything to actually confirm the report from dispatch. They had been given the information that had the person had provided it. They did not go to that household to find out exactly what was the report, what was the weapon, or why was they believed he was possibly armed. They just relied on the secondhand information from dispatch.
Ms. Ortiz, address harmless error.
Your Honor, I don't really have much to say on that. I've read the Serafin case.
Under Commonwealth v. White, tell me about harmless error.
If, in fact, the court determines that the evidence of the key in the ignition and the headlights on, et cetera, is sufficient to establish that he was operating, then I don't know that there was much leg for Mr. Granado to stand on. But I think that we shouldn't necessarily jump to that point without also addressing the conduct that occurred on the day in question. I think somebody, I don't know if it was the Attorney General, made the comment that it was silly for Mr. Granado to stay, or silly to assume that Mr. Granado didn't know what was going on. But again, the testimony of the evidence in the statement of facts didn't include whether the windows are up or on, whether his radio was up or was on or not. So even though the officers may have said that they yelled to him repeatedly, you can't assume that he actually heard them. They did not actually...
But right after that, he threw something in the back, which we found out later to be the key.
Well, I don't know that they found it afterwards.
Isn't that the sequence in the statement of facts?
Well, from the statement of facts, it says, he observed the male sitting in the driver's seat, take the keys out of the ignition, and throw the keys in the back seat. So this isn't something that he found out subsequently. This is, from what I understand, sort of like a stream of consciousness. This is what I observed happening, that he was able to identify that it was not, in fact, a weapon. But the grand scheme of things here is that all of the totality of the circumstances as they are, with Mr. Granato late at night by himself in a parking, legally parked, not having any prior contact with the police, two officers approaching with guns drawn, and if he
heard... Is there something in the record, that in the statement of facts, that says he had no prior contact with the police?
Well, I'm referring to the fact that the officer, when he previously saw... The Cadillac.
No prior contact that night.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I'm sorry. There was nothing to indicate that he had any prior contact with police that night that would have given him belief that these officers were intending to find him. I think all those circumstances together place it beyond Dixon, perhaps not quite as coercive as Hassan, but regardless of where you fall in that spectrum, either way, it's such that it's a under reasonable person standard would objectively have been found to be the equivalent of being in custody. So we'd argue the statements that were subsequently obtained by questioning of the officers would have been inadmissible under Miranda. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. We will step down and greet counsel. Let me make inquiry. Is Mr. Califf here?